First off, this afternoon, we're going to talk about the Energy Action Plan. And Mr. Schmitz, I think you're going to introduce the topic.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Council. I'm going to be absolutely, totally brief. It is my pleasure to, one, thank the Council and the Mayor for the support that you have given the Energy Commission in the contracting for the preparation of the document which is now in your hands, the City of Rochester Energy Action Plan 2016. Just very briefly, I want to introduce two people that I hope you've become familiar with, Matus and Ali, who are the fellows here this summer working both with the city and with the Public Works Department in two projects, one dealing with sustainability and the possibility of a person being involved on an ongoing basis in sustainability, and Matus on the Energy Action Plan and how it might be rolled out. I want to introduce Aaron Heitkamp from Wink & Associates, who has prepared the plan that it is here in your hands, and I will turn things over to her.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mayor and council members, thank you for having us today. This has been about a year in the making, getting to this point where we have the Energy Action Plan in front of you for consideration and approval today. We appreciate the opportunity to work with the city on the project and to be here today. A quick introduction to my right over here in, with the glasses on top of his head is my colleague Bill Brown, who has been involved in the project from the very beginning. We do have some other team members as well who contributed significantly to the project that are not here today, but from the work side, this was definitely a team effort. In terms of our presentation objectives today, we want to familiarize the council or the committee with the Energy Action Plan development process. I think the process part of it is pretty important, as well as the content ultimately in the plan that, as I understand, has been provided to all of you for consideration and ultimately for approval. We want to discuss and elicit your feedback on high priority recommended actions and next steps, and then prepare the council's to consider EAP approval.
Expecting some of that to be up there.
Oh, it should be. Thank you. All right. There we go. Thank you. So, just a few words on background and context. This will be repetitive for those of you that were involved in the initial decision to task the Rochester Energy Commission with the development of an Energy Action Plan, but I know this is, again, a few years in the making, so I'm assuming that all of you were at this table 3 or so years ago during that process. The impetus to develop an Energy Action Plan has really been, as I understand it, driven by an awareness that nationally cities that are looking at aggressive growth trajectories are looking at opportunities to grow in a more sustainable way, and in particular looking at climate change and energy as kind of the center of sustainable growth opportunities. The other piece of this, I think, is very clearly Rochester wants to be a leader, and the DMC initiative is a demonstration of leadership in many regards, and it's an opportunity as the city goes through a comprehensive planning process to integrate sustainability goals and objectives into that planning process. And as I understand it, again, all of those pieces came together to cause the city council to task the REC with developing the Energy Action Plan. Let's take a minute here to talk a little bit about carbon and energy goals. Ultimately, you can have a big picture objective to grow more sustainably, to source more energy from clean sources, to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult to pursue any of that without some goals and objectives in mind. The basis then for the goals and objectives is the Energy Commission's determination that the EAP would be prepared using the goals established under the Minnesota Next Generation Energy Act of 2007 as a guideline. So I'm using some terms there that are a little more nebulous, not super concrete. Ultimately, the idea here is that we, the city wanted those goals to be a guideline. However, one of the first things that we did, that Wink did when we got involved in the project, was to queue up a conversation about the reality of how difficult those goals would be for a city like Rochester to meet if your growth trajectory proves out as to what is being contemplated today. So the we had a conversation with the Energy Commission about different ways that you could still align the city with those goals, and ultimately where we landed was to say, if you look at these goals through as an intensity goal and put them kind of in the context of the larger state, you're going to have regions of the state, cities that are growing slower or declining in growth, and other areas that are growing more aggressively. So what we where we ultimately landed was to align these goals through the establishment of an intensity goal. So ultimately, there's a formula for how you can do this, and that's specifically contemplated in the Energy Action Plan, or EAP as I'm going to call it. If you want to get into the nitty-gritty detail, but the idea is to take those targets and evaluate whether or not the city accomplishes them on a per capita basis or on a growth basis. And there's, again, different ways that you can do that, but we've contemplated one of those in the EAP. Making the case for the Energy Action Plan. Again, here, this is just some background that I think is important to pause and consider, given this project is a long time in the making. And I think certainly there's different views on how important sustainability is to communities, how important energy and climate action are. And without question, I'm sure there are varying views in this room. Ultimately, I think the take-home message here is that an energy action plan has the potential to deliver significant value to the community well above and beyond just environmental benefits. And I don't mean just to minimize them, but there are going to be other societal and economic benefits that the city will realize if you do this really, if you do it well. And we can look to other communities around the country that have done so, or maybe 15 to 20 years, the leading cities and communities across the country are realizing those benefits, and we'll talk a little bit about those communities during discussion of the benchmarking exercise. So this diagram is intended to communicate the process that we went through. The project was broken into six tasks, and the size of each of these blocks is intended to communicate how much effort and time went into each of those tasks. The third task, the assessment of the greenhouse gas emissions inventory, the evaluation of energy-related goals, regulations, and mandates, those pieces were the messier pieces. It's all about gathering data, building some baseline relationship with stakeholders in the community so that we could have really rigorous conversations about practical realities, budgeting process, interdepartmental, interorganizational relationships, those kind of things. So that was a big task. Just the exercise of pulling together a greenhouse gas emissions inventory for a community of this size was a significant piece. You'll note, too, that the community engagement part we're trying to convey here, look at the little green circle with the arrows going both directions, that community engagement wasn't a piece that we just carved out. We really tried to integrate it throughout each step in the process. And to the extent that people have questions about the specific exercises and actions that we took in that regard, we'd be happy to speak to them. But I'm not going to talk in much detail about those pieces today. We're really focusing on the kind of the technical analysis and then the conclusions that we landed on and recommendations about next steps. So the first task was the comprehensive plan review, which was really just about getting our team up to speed on the comprehensive planning process and understanding how the EAP would fit into the comprehensive plan ultimately, but also how we could collaborate with the consultants that were working on the P2S process. And we did that, again, a big part of that came through during the community engagement process. And then also just ultimately understanding post Energy Action Plan approval, what will happen with that document and how it might be integrated into the comprehensive plan. The second task is the benchmarking comparative analysis that I referred to briefly just a moment ago. So I'm using two terms here because we had some difficulties through the Energy Commission using terms that meant something to people that was meaningful. So the reason we started out calling it a benchmarking analysis ultimately action, the form of some sort of an energy action plan, 10 or more years prior to when we initiated this project, and to do an evaluation of how successful their efforts have been, where they realized the greatest success, and then to think about whether or not those opportunities for success are applicable here in Rochester. I already spoke to task three. Task four was kind of a discrete task, an assessment of available incentives and alternative funding sources. I will say that by no means is that task a comprehensive assessment. Ultimately, there are a ton of opportunities at the federal level, at the state level, at the regional level to tap into resources, whether they be grant or loan programs or other resources where you can bring expertise into the city to support programs and initiatives. There's just such a broad range of opportunities here, and ultimately, I think the advice that I would offer is that when the EAP is finalized, approved, and there is an implementation plan in place, that depending upon what that includes, you go back and look at other opportunities and really deepen that look. On task five, I already spoke to community engagement, and then task six really was just the development of the plan, so taking all of these pieces and pulling them together. So scoping climate change and energy goals. This is a, bear with me for the next couple slides because this technical piece is not going to resonate very easily with some of you, and I'll try to make this as straightforward and link it to your reality as practically as I can. But I think it's helpful to understand a little bit of the background here. One of the first things we did, again, in kicking off the project with the Energy Commission was to address how you ultimately measure what it is that you're trying to do. And the global protocols, not just for cities, but even more predominantly for corporations, is to use third-party, established, accepted protocols for measuring greenhouse gas emissions. Those protocols divide six greenhouse gas emissions into three categories, scope one, scope two, and scope three. So to boil this down, scope one really is direct emissions from city-owned assets. Some of it can be controlled. That gets into a little bit more of a nebulous area. But so think about RPUs, power generating assets, and emissions that come directly from those units, or the wastewater reclamation plant and emissions associated with processing of wastewater. So those are examples of scope one emissions. The scope two piece is going to be indirect greenhouse gas emissions resulting from the generation of electricity that is purchased by the city, so generated off-site by assets not owned or controlled by the city, but purchased. Well, this is where this gets a little fuzzy here. Think one example of this, I guess the best example I can think of right now, is emissions from power that the city purchases or heat that the city purchases, so natural gas that's purchased from the MERC, for example. Those associated emissions are emissions that you have less control over generally than scope one, but still potentially some depending upon which category you're looking at. Scope three is going to be kind of everything else, emissions from sources not owned or directly controlled by the city. You will note in subsequent slides that we refer to scope three emissions as community emissions, and I'll try to keep making that connection as we go through so you can process it. The idea here is we want the city to be thinking about all of your city residents, your industrial, commercial, and individual residents, and their activities that drive emissions. And in a little bit here, we'll get to what the numbers look like, and that'll be a pretty important distinction. So the other thing to, I think about here is is a fantastic tool that certainly has its limitations, especially when you're using it for the first time, because there will be things that the city and the community are already doing that aren't obviously captured in the numbers. So for example, if let's say the city made a significant investment in solar power, you would not see those emissions, and you wouldn't be able to track in your first inventory a reduction in emissions because that's just part of your baseline. Going forward, however, if you prepare inventories on a regular basis, whether it's on an annual or triannual basis, there's different recommended best practices in that regard, you would be able to see those reductions and ultimately associate them with those activities. So just keep that very in mind. We had a lot of questions in the development of the inventory about, well, where do you see the fact that the Olmsted County Waste Energy Facility is using waste, which has close to a zero greenhouse gas emissions inventory footprint associated with it? How is that reflected? You don't really see that, other than you just might see a little lower level of emissions in that category as a starting point or in your baseline. Let's talk a little bit about the different components of an inventory that are important to think about up front. The first is this issue of boundaries, which really speaks to control, and that is directly tied to those scope 1, 2, and 3 emission categories that I talked about. When we get to the very end of the presentation on the plan, there'll be a big focus on significant impact, significant control opportunities. The connection is very real here. If you think about assets that the city owns that are significant sources of emissions. Again, RPU, power generating assets, the wastewater reclamation plant assets are examples of significant emission sources that the city has control over. Much greater control than in the case of most other opportunities, number one. Number two, there's some significant impact opportunities there, but in a lot of cases where the city has control, the impact is going to be less. We'll talk about the examples of those couple pieces that where you've got full significant impact, significant control, but that's not always going to be the case. In terms of sources, an inventory captures emissions from stationary combustion. So again, the RPU power generating assets are an example. Stationary process really refers to processes, whether industrial processes or city-owned assets where you're burning energy, but it's not energy that you're generating. Those emissions are captured as well, and then mobile combustion fees. So any city-owned fleets and any of the community's transportation fuel use is also accounted for. This is getting really far into the weeds, so I'm going to be quick on the emissions piece. So again, there are six greenhouse gas emissions that the world accounts for. Typically, those four from industrial processes, HFCs, et cetera, are not a significant component of a city, and in particular in the case of the city of Rochester, we looked at it and said it's really kind of de minimis contribution, and it's a lot harder to track that data down because it's typically going to be your industrial residents in the city. Ultimately, we convert everything into what CO2e, so carbon dioxide equivalents is what it's referred to, and more generically, we just refer to that as carbon. I think we already spoke to a couple of these pieces. So what does the inventory look like? If you go to the far right side under the percentage of total and hone in on the scope 1 subtotal, scope 2 subtotal, and scope 3 subtotal, those are the numbers that give you a really quick look at where the most significant emission sources are, and we can then dig into a little bit of the detail, and I'll come back around and talk to the detail here in a minute. Take-home message from this slide is the scope 3 total is 96% of the city's total emissions. So again, to that point about control, you have some control over what your residents do, right? But not necessarily absolute control. There are going to be certain areas where there's more opportunity than others. And in any case, we're going to dig in on each of these scopes and talk about where the biggest opportunities are. So this slide reflects the city's scope 1 and 2 emissions. And you'll see the largest emission sources included are of the RPU assets, the Silver Lake plant, and the Cascade Creek. the wastewater reclamation plant, the city's large buildings, and then diesel fuel applications. So whether that's use of diesel fuel in your transit in your fleets or for other purposes, heating or otherwise. With the biggest opportunities without question coming from as collectively from the RPU assets. With regard to scope 3 emissions, which again are the community sources, the largest sources include heating, so natural gas, electricity, and transportation. You'll note that at the bottom of that sliver, it's community waste. That number is pretty small, 3.3% of total. When I get to the benchmarking exercise, we'll talk about other communities where that was a significant opportunity for emissions reductions. And because this community already manages waste, 100% of its waste, essentially, in a way where, when you look at it from an emissions accounting perspective, you've got almost a zero carbon footprint, or very, very small carbon footprint from the waste-to-energy facility. So that, instead of being a kind of a problem area where you say this is a significant source of emissions, what can we do and how do we think about reducing waste and or capturing the emissions and energy content, say, from a landfill, you don't have that dynamic here. That'll come into play when we talk about benchmarking. Shifting to, going back to the project scope task 2, which was the benchmarking report or comparative analysis. This is a summary of the four, what we're calling sectors, which is a term that confuses some people, but in the case of all three cities that we benchmarked against, which were Portland, Minneapolis, and Sacramento, Portland, Oregon, I should be clear, most cities think about the opportunities to reduce emissions and make changes in terms of their energy profile in terms of sectors. So instead of thinking about a manufacturing industrial sector, these are sectors categorized by emissions. So the first is buildings and energy. So where I put, we identify these as goals. This doesn't mean we're recommending to the city that these would be goals. This is where we, these are kind of generic goals that if somebody said, well, what have other leading cities done? We could pass this over and say, here are some goals you might want to look at as a general rule. Cities have found opportunities here. So the first is the expansion of a renewable energy profile. And some of the cities have adopted strategies where they're looking to supply approximately 50% of all energy used in buildings from renewable sources. Now, in a city like Rochester, where you have a municipal utility that has a contract in place like RPU does here, this gets to be more complicated. Doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities there, but it's not as straightforward as a city that's just going out and they have a lot of flexibility to diversify their energy supply. Again, RPU is doing some fantastic things. They've got some other really great things on the docket. We'll talk about how that will ultimately be translated in the inventory going forward. The second goal then under buildings and energy is to reduce total energy use of existing buildings by increasing energy efficiency. Any energy expert in the world will tell you we still have a ton of low-hanging fruit, even in our most industrial societies. There's a lot of opportunities still in energy efficiency, and there are organizations that are true experts in this space. The Center for Energy and Environment, or CEE, that's been working on the DMC Energy Project is an example of an organization that has many, many years of expertise in this area and can speak really well to effective strategies to advance energy efficiency. You will see that as a significant part of the recommendations that we get to ultimately. Transportation being about 22% of the emissions here, and in particular community transportation, again, that's another significant opportunity. In the case of these leading cities, their focus really was on the increase of public transit services, and they found that those were effective strategies. With regard to land use, the idea of complete neighborhoods or walkability and really evaluating how communities function and how people get to the 7 or 8 places they might need to get to in a given day, and thinking about building infrastructure for walkability, bikeability, limiting vehicle miles traveled based on your transportation roads infrastructure. That's all kind of part of that idea, and again, we'll come back around to that in our recommendations. The last piece, again, on solid waste, these three cities realized really significant opportunities to mitigate emissions in that regard. Again, we're not going to see that here in Rochester. I'm going to jump ahead now to the final task of drafting the Energy Action Plan and kind of get everybody up to speed as to what the plan reflects today. So it reflects feedback received by the Rochester Energy Commission. I know we have Ray introduced me, but there are at least three other commission members here today who may, if you guys wouldn't mind raising your hands. So the commission was great to work with. We've got an absolutely passionate, invested group of folks involved in that panel. And there was a lot of back and forth getting to a point where they were comfortable with content and we could get it all done. Once we got to a point where REC had provided and we'd incorporated much of their feedback, we then presented to the RPU board, which was part of our original contract that the RPU board needed to sign off on the EAP before it went to the council. So we went through that process, integrated RPU board input, and then back to the commission again, incorporated all of that input, and the draft, pre-final draft that you've all seen incorporates all of those pieces. The EAP also provides documentation of findings from each of those six tasks. So again, I'm not going into detail on a lot of those today, but to the extent that is of interest to you, primarily in the appendices, there is as much detail as you could want on all of the conversations that we had with community stakeholders, including community surveys. We met with individuals from the Department of Public Works, Department of Administration, Department of Finance, Wastewater Treatment Reclamation Plant, and the Olmsted County Waste Energy Facility. So all of that, again, notes from all those discussions and so forth are included in the EAP if that's of interest. And ultimately, the purpose of those discussions was to pull that input into the plan and to incorporate it. The EAP also provides and prioritizes recommendations, which is ultimately what we're trying to get to. What are the opportunities? What are the most significant impacts, significant opportunities? So we will come back around to those, and they are categorized into three categories, including power generation, transportation, and buildings. So that's where we're at. Priority one, in the category of power generation, you'll see each of these slides. I'm going to watch, I think there's 9 or 10 of them. At the very top, you'll see kind of the big picture case for why this is a priority. I'm not going to repeat each of the emphasis, but to the extent that you need that reference to kind of understand and connect the dots, it's there. In this case, the points are that the city can prepare for capturing effects of carbon mitigation from RPU-generated power and other power generators in the region. Certain opportunities will not be ripe until 2030 when the SIMPA contract expires, RPU's contract with SIMPA. So for those of you who are not familiar with or don't understand how that contract works, I'm going to spend just a couple minutes explaining it and explaining how it translates into impacts on the greenhouse gas emissions inventory because it's very important. So that contract, again, goes through 2030, and contemplated in it is a contracted rate of delivery, or CROD, where RPU has to purchase, to the extent that it has the demand, up to 216 megawatts of power from the MISO grid every year. And that grid is just your electricity grid, but MISO specifically runs kind of all the way from Texas up to Minnesota and one or two states on either side, so kind of central region of the United States. Part of that contract then is that RPU sells all of the power that they generate to SIMPA, which is the regional grid, essentially. The way emissions inventories work is that in that scenario, we cannot account for just what RPU is generating, what their emissions footprint is associated with their power. What we have to account for is the emissions footprint associated with the power that is purchased off of the MISO grid. So there's an emissions factor that's calculated. You can do it a little bit on a regional basis, so you don't have to look at that whole central region, the United States. There's a kind of an upper Midwest area, so it's about a fifth of the whole MISO area that we look at, and that's what we used when we did our analysis. But at the end of the day, the take-home message here is if RPU were to go 100% renewable tomorrow, that impact would be diluted in what you would see in the inventory. You're not going to see it. It's not that there's going to be any impact, but it's going to be a diluted impact. The other part of this that's important is that there is a pretty dramatic, aggressive shift across the United States right now in a movement toward much lower carbon intensity fuel and power. So even though you're not going to realize the entire effect of RPU's decisions immediately, the city will realize that shift. It'll automatically be translated. And because the region that we're using, that you're in for the emissions factor is changing at an even more aggressive pace than much of the rest of the country, you'll see pretty significant impacts in that regard. Again, there's detail in the EAP to the extent that people want to understand specifically what the data sources are, what those regions are, all of that's contemplated, and we'd be happy to answer questions if any come up. The other thing I guess that I want to speak to is if you look at these specific bulleted items in terms of solar, for example. So increased solar, to the extent that solar installations are RPU assets, you're going to have the same dynamic that I just explained. To the extent that you have programs where you support distributed solar, so whether it's your individual residents or businesses that do rooftop installations, for example, generate their own power, and then probably have just a little bit extra that they sell. The part that they sell into the marketplace gets sold to RPU, and RPU sells it to MISO, same dynamic in terms of the impact on the inventory. However, the demand from those buildings, from your community, whether, again, it's industrial, commercial, or individual residents, would be mitigated, and you would see a direct emissions reduction in that regard. In terms of increased hydroelectric, so this is a piece where the RPU, that dynamic with your contracting is going to play out. However, to my earlier point, RPU is investing in planning and evaluating a number of opportunities to mitigate the emissions associated with the power that RPU generates. And I think it's important to know as a community that they're doing that, and it's pretty aggressive in the grand scheme of things. So in terms of the hydroelectric piece, they're evaluating, again, within the confines of their SIMPA contract, expansion of hydroelectric power, and that is a piece that actually, could, up to a certain amount, there's an exemption, and it could be accounted for, and you would see direct emissions reductions. In terms of, I'll skip quickly to the increased biogas utilization. So this is another opportunity where the wastewater reclamation plant is currently using a state-of-the-art, they've just got this rock star anaerobic digestion system where they take the organic material that they pull out of the wastewater treatment process and use it as an energy source to generate biogas, and then that biogas is used to power units on site so that their whole process is less energy intensive, or in the carbon footprint associated with it is less energy intensive. They have started a program that, as I understand it, the City Council has been involved in, so you're probably aware of it, but maybe not in how it connects to this discussion, which is the track freeze program. So as I understand it, there will be certified collectors that will go around to all of the restaurants and hotels as well, I believe, and be collecting that track freeze, which is actually really high energy content stuff. They will use that as a supplement in their digester and generate more power from it. So it sounds like it would be relatively low impact, but they might see a 5 to 10% reduction in their carbon footprint as a result of that activity. So that's one example of a near-term opportunity. Increased solid waste utilization for power. This one I'm going to talk to in a minute because it kind of crosses another category, but ultimately this is looking to the OF facility, and again, the reality that the power generated by OF has a very small carbon footprint associated with it. To the extent that that can be expanded and you have community users that come by directly from them, there's an opportunity there for emissions reductions that would, again, go directly to the bottom line of your inventory. Um, supply side efficiency. So this is an area, again, where there's significant control because there are few assets, significant impact because, to my previous discussion, there's always opportunities in efficiency. I can say, however, that in the case of RPU, they run a pretty tight operation. As an example, losses from distribution from RPU are about 1.7%, whereas the national average is at 6%. So they're already running a pretty tight ship. That doesn't mean that there might be other opportunities there to mitigate emissions from what they're doing. The same diluted effect would apply, however, I have to clarify that. So optimization of efficient community heat and power generation. So this is a reference to the Energy Integration Committee, which has been established after the project that was funded by the McKnight Foundation that Evergreen Energy and Center for Energy and Environment did collaboratively and came up with some recommendations. And as I understand it, one of the next steps is this Energy Integration Committee is going to think about how to implement those recommendations in the DMC zones of focus. Ultimately, the point here is that there is an opportunity to break down organizational silos in the community and help organizations think about how they can collaboratively more efficiently generate heat and power instead of thinking just through the lens of their own organization. Ultimately, the work of that committee is going to be demonstrative of a bigger opportunity. And those collaborative pieces where you have to break down those silos and walls, those tend to be some of the most difficult pieces to pursue and accomplish. But in this case, there's a significant opportunity here to drive success and then to expand lessons learned to the rest of the community. In case of the Olmsted Waste Energy Facility, again, I just referenced kind of the opportunity there. I wanted to clarify, however, that there are limits that apply in their contract with RPU. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but it's somewhere in the range of 20 to 25 community users or customers that could contract directly with OF for, could be for steam or electricity. And there's also a limit on the amount, the total amount of heat and steam electricity that could be sold. Let me go back here real quick. Again, where you're going to see these impacts, if these opportunities are pursued, is in your scope 2 and 3 emissions. Again, the scope 3 pieces, the community piece, is the most significant, so there's a real opportunity there. The other thing I wanted to mention here quickly, I just became aware in recent weeks that the city of Rochester is one of, I believe it's 3 or 4 communities across the state of Minnesota that are doing this sister city program with cities in Germany. And so you have individuals from the community here. I don't know if anybody present.
Few
people in the room that are participating. So I think, from what I understand, I sat next to Ken Smith from Evergreen Energy at an event the other day, and he shared with me one of the first experiences of walking around and seeing what those sister cities are doing in very effectively, very efficiently. There's certainly an opportunity to learn from them and to bring some of those lessons learned back here. So that's just a piece that I wanted to commend the city for pursuing the opportunity, and hopefully there'll be some ideas that come out of that effort as well. Category 2, transportation. So again, community-wide transportation emissions account for 20% of the city's emissions. So there's a material opportunity here to realize reductions. There are, I think we've got 5 or 6 different ideas for how to influence the emissions from transportation sources. The first is both a significant impact, significant control opportunity with regard to the development of transportation corridors and nodes that and parking infrastructure that minimize vehicle miles traveled. That piece is incorporated in the comprehensive planning process, and one of the deliverables, as I understand it from our conversations with the different contractors working on the project, is that they should associate a carbon emissions impact associated with each of those different models for developing infrastructure. My preliminary conversations with them would suggest that they saw some impact based on the different models that they were looking at. Maybe that the numbers don't sound huge initially, but even 2 or 3% is real and significant when you're talking about 20% chunk of your emissions inventory. The second opportunity, significant impact opportunity, is the expansion of ride sharing programs. So this is one of those pieces that is a softer piece, right? It's all about programmatic development and partnerships and how you incentivize people's behavior, which is sometimes, those are some of the hardest pieces, the least technical, but the hardest pieces to actually drive change. This is a piece where I think you could look at programs around the country that have been successful and take some of those lessons learned and incorporate them. But it's ultimately a question of interest, commitment, dedication, and collaboration from the relevant organizations to really drive those programs forward. Also in the transportation category, electric charging stations. So this is a little bit of that chicken or egg conversation when it comes to the electrification of the transportation system. So people are hesitant to buy electric vehicles. I'm just talking about individuals here. We'll come back around to talk about city fleets in a minute. With regard to individuals, or even your industrial commercial residents who have fleets of vehicles, there's a hesitation to go electric if the charging infrastructure isn't going to be there. As the technology gets better and battery life is longer and fewer people have to charge outside of their home, that dynamic is changing a little bit. But I think an awareness of those opportunities and that reality is still not all that prevalent. And so there might be a community education opportunity here to educate people. Part of it, again, would be the provision of additional electric charging stations, so to get kind of over that mindset, but then also just practically for people to have the opportunity to charge in the city while they're at work or at a venue, whatever they might be doing. This is a piece where there are definitely programs at the state and federal level where you can source capital to help pay for that infrastructure. It may not be 100%, but you should be able to source capital to the extent that the city decides that's an interesting opportunity. The second one, focus on alternative fuel vehicles for the city fleet. The Department of Public Works has done extensive evaluation of the city's bus fleet and looked at conversion to alternative fuels. There is, without question, an opportunity to do a compressed natural gas conversion, which just off the top would give you about a 50% reduction in emissions from that fleet. You could also get creative and source renewable natural gas, which is another kind of bigger picture opportunity that would further reduce it. That's kind of pie in the sky, probably a little longer term, but certainly some opportunity there. I understand that they are watching closely the city of Duluth's experiment with electric buses. So some of the mindset is, well, why do you want to go to CNG? It feels like it's kind of an interim step. If we're going to make the investment in the infrastructure, then why don't we go all the way to electrification? And if Duluth can make it happen and avoid some of the concerns about cold weather issues, then one would think that Rochester would probably do just fine. Again, this is a place where there are significant resources available to help cities advance electrification of bus fleets. So a piece to kind of watch where those incentive programs are evolving and how they're evolving. Increase public transit to reduce single occupancy trips. So I know this, again, is part of the comprehensive planning exercise. But I think this is a bigger piece than just that. Ultimately, some of the feedback that I understand has come from the community is that if those networks were wider, if the service was more frequent, then I would be more interested in taking public transit. That is a study in and of itself, and I am not a transportation expert. So I'm going to refrain from making any more comments in that regard, but there's potentially some opportunity there. Then the final one is increased greenways, pedestrian and bike traffic only. So this goes back to my comments about complete neighborhoods, complete communities, kind of a concept where if you create incentives and develop the community in a way that people can walk and bike, then you reduce individual vehicle traffic. A big part of this, I think, is bike lanes. If you look at lots of cities across the U.S., but Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minneapolis in particular, is oftentimes cited as the most bikeable city in America. A big part of that is the establishment of bike lanes. You provide a safe place for people to ride, and then there's also a community education piece here, and provide incentives and just awareness of the impact that has on your community, both in terms of reducing traffic congestion, reducing local air pollution, addressing climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. Lots of opportunities there to really engage your community. and influence the behavior, number one, but number two, create a little bit of a different community dynamic. Category three is buildings. So in this case, we've categorized these opportunities in a few different ways. The first significant impact significant control opportunity is sustainable building policies along all of these or integrated into all of those different building or the steps in the building process, planning, design, construction, commissioning, so on and so forth. In this case, I have had through this planning process several conversations with individuals working to kind of get smarter on how much flexibility does the city really have here. Some of this is governed by state law. Some of these pieces ultimately are maybe not governed by state law and you have some more flexibility, but there seems to be a fair amount of hesitancy to move forward on this without really rigorous buy-in from your construction trades community, the businesses that are serving Rochester. And I think there's a real interest among those folks to contribute and think about how to do this well and do it creatively and not make their lives more difficult, make the projects more expensive, and maybe questionably accomplish ultimately the goals. So there's a real opportunity here. That's a piece, however, that really requires, again, collaboration and inclusion of the folks that really know how that process works and where the best opportunities are. Retrocommissioning, I call this out separately because not surprisingly, oftentimes your older buildings are the least efficient and provide the greatest opportunity for improvement. They tend to get the least attention and focus unless specific attention and focus is brought to them. So again, this is an opportunity for programming that can really capitalize on those significant opportunities. So, and then moving on to energy conservation programs. To my comment earlier about the low-hanging fruit associated with energy conservation, that I can say that statement 10 times over, and it still probably won't have the same, it won't take the way that I would love for it to. And ultimately, even if it did take, this is not about what the people in this room do, at least individually, or the decisions that the city can directly make, other than to really engage and educate your community about these opportunities. The programs that both Merck and RPU offer are excellent programs and have realized where they've got people engaged, they're really seeing significant reductions and energy savings. However, uptake rates are pretty low, and that is not, Rochester's not exceptional in that regard. That's kind of the national reality. There are cities and utilities that have done a really good job of developing community awareness and incentive programs, and I think you need both of those. You have to have both parts of that coin. People have to be aware of the opportunity, they have to be engaged and pulled in, but then the incentive to do it has to be significant enough that people actually follow through. One of the individuals that I work with from CEE and some sustainability leadership groups is, and I've had a conversation about this where I say, so you guys do this all day long, what do you see in terms of uptake rate? And they see a 7% uptake rate, which is still pretty small. So then I go, what does that mean? Does that mean 7% of the people that you talk to and you give recommendations to actually implement? She said, no, it's 7% that we talk to, we give a whole suite of recommendations to fully implement those. So just to give you a little ballpark sense of kind of, even with very aggressive effective programs, that's about where you land. But at the end of the day, they're fairly low-cost opportunities that can deliver pretty significant dividends. Water consumption is the same dynamic, kind of need the education and the incentive piece, but it's a piece that seems to people are less aware about. My conclusion in the state of Minnesota is that people tend not to associate water with energy, first of all, whereas there's a very direct significant association, number one. Number two, we live in such a water-rich state and region that it's not a focus area. People don't think as much about conserving water as you would in California or Arizona or other places where water is a more scarce resource. So, again, the education piece is significant there, as is the incentive. So, to finalize the discussion here, take all of this data and an awareness of what the kind of practical realities are, where you know the opportunities are, and bring stakeholders to the table to figure out what partnerships can be established, where you've got financial or other resources you can bring to bear, where those resources might be missing, how we bring those resources to the table. All of those coordination pieces are going to be critical. Part of that conversation, too, needs to be integration into the comprehensive plan. So as I understand it, this document will be kind of a standalone, separate component of the comprehensive plan, the other pieces of the comprehensive plan. Without question, there's going to be opportunity for integration. The transportation piece in particular is a very bright opportunity to kind of both bring those pieces together, so there needs to be some integration there. I already spoke to the prioritization of actions, and then what kind of, once you get through those pieces, which are significant efforts, it's a big deal to get through all those pieces, largely because you've got to bring a diverse set of stakeholders to the table, and you've got to get people working together, and you have to bring resources to it. So once you figure it out kind of how you're going to do that, set up a timeline or establish a timeline, assign responsibilities, identify and pursue funding mechanisms to bring additional resources from outside the city, and then plan to evaluate performance against the goals that have been established so that you can continue driving toward the accomplishment of them on schedule. And that is all I have today.
Thank you, Erin. There are several resource people here. If the council has any questions, there are five of us from the Energy Commission. Mitzi is here from the Planning Department. If you're interested in procedure in terms of the comprehensive plan occurring over the next few months, city people who have been involved in discussions leading to this document, anything we can help you with.
All right, thank you. Questions or comments from the council, Mr. Ruskin?
Thank you, Aaron. Nice job. When I brought this forward to the council years ago, I think there was a lot of concern from people that the Energy Commission was going to overstep its boundaries and dissect too much of what private people were doing and so on. And I think this is right on to what we want to do. It makes us aware and gives us some goals to really focus on. I look back at some of my notes here from a couple of years ago, and they're kind of still all over the place a little bit. And I think now we've got a clear direction and we're headed down the right road. I might not agree with everything that comes forward in this thing over the next few years, but I certainly think that we've got now a clear goal and some clear direction, and that was very well done. So, good job by you and the commission.
Mr. Campion.
So one thing you kind of hit on is some of the limitations because of contractual obligations that RPU can kind of, how far they can move the bar or move the needle. And one of the things is, I worry a bit about focus on this book score a little bit. Like, there's a book score of a carbon footprint, but there's also a quality of life of, you know, we reduce impact, sure, it's diminished returns because we can't realize all of that for our report card, but there's also a quality of life impact. And so is it a separate measure that we would need to be able to also kind of maybe gauge what the quality of life impact for some of these changes would be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So to the extent that the city wants to evaluate the opportunity to develop and grow in a more sustainable way using metrics other than just energy and greenhouse gas emissions, or ultimately that's about climate change, mm-hmm. Whether you're talking about local air pollutants and reduction in incidence of asthma or allergies or other things, which is a very real element of a reduction of local generation or reflect. There's a real opportunity there if you go for cleaner energy generation locally. I'll leave it at that. There are certainly other components too. So I think the complete neighborhood walkability piece, to some of my comments, is all about what kind of community people want to live in and what are you hearing from your community. Ultimately, which measures of sustainable growth are most important and most relevant for Rochester, I think can only be concluded through pretty comprehensive stakeholder engagement. A lot of that has already happened through the planning process, and somebody could really dig into that and pluck out the pieces and say, these are clearly the five or six areas that are most important in terms of quality of life. Let's come up with the best metric and then track how how the Energy Action Plan helps advance those. You could certainly do that. It wasn't part of our scope.
Sure. Thanks.
Yeah. And I think just very quickly, we need to recognize that DMC has adopted as one of their primary goals, at least in part of their district, a net zero energy situation, so that we need to recognize that they see that as an inducement to bringing the kinds of people that they're interested in having in Rochester in the next 20 years. And I think this fits neatly into what DMC is talking about.
Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Bojack.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I really applaud the aspects of the plan that really focus on conservation. It seems like the plan kind of broadly is the greenhouse gas historical inventory and then kind of the conservation aspects of it. At the time the WENC came back for additional funding for the continuation of the greenhouse gas inventory, I kind of raised some questions on that, just based on that, knowing that the equation's kind of dominated by that, where we get our energy from, and SEMPA, through 2030, and a lot can happen in the next 14 years. So given the resources, I would have liked to see a little bit more focused on the conservation piece of it. But now that we have this inventory, it's a benchmark, it's something that we can use. But I really think, really focus on those conservation aspects, and that's the piece I really like. Thank you.
Mr. Wojak.
For a couple comments, but before that, I just had a question that came in about when we look at our waste stream, do we look at what Mayo's doing with their non-infectious waste? Because my understanding is they burn something like 27 tons of waste a year and they're not producing anything from it. Is that part of our calculation?
Yes. Yep. We got data from Mayo and some of your larger community producers of energy. So that's how that kind of comes out.
Perfect.
They're producing energy, but we also look at it from a waste perspective, whether that waste is generating emissions.
So then just some general comments. I mean, obviously, I like the plan. I've been involved. I've seen it way too many times at this point. I can pretty much recite it from memory. There have been some good things, too, to your point, about things that we can do in the interim in terms of conservation. One of the simple things is, we're replacing some inefficient gas burners with very efficient gas burners. And, that's actually identified as one of the priorities in there, and it's something that we're already working on. And that's going to be a huge efficiency gain for us. Also, I think that even though SEMPA is not perhaps obligated to do it, they see the writing on the wall and they're going forward with some major community solar investments that are going to be open to us. So even in the interim, we're able to do some things to push the needle on that a little bit. That electric was about 44%, but there's a lot of things we can do in terms of transportation and land use in the community that we have broad control over, and that's important to have as part of the comprehensive planning. I'm excited about potentially skipping CNG and going to electric. I'm glad that if it falls flat on its face, it's happening to Duluth and not us. But I do think that that's clearly the way of the future, and that when we looked into it, that gas infrastructure was so expensive, or we were going to get a not as good of a deal, that I'm glad that we're taking the pause to see if electric is the way to go forward. I'm personally quite high on geothermal, and my understanding, I don't know, is Mark Koshevar here? Probably out fishing or something. He was very excited about the combined heat power plant that he saw in Germany. In fact, my understanding is if you say that around him, he gets really excited. But there's great potential, I think, probably for geothermal and district geothermal in town, which is just a far more efficient way of handling the heating of our buildings, which is principally all natural gas right now. And So I think there's tremendous opportunities pointed out in here, but the ones that we have the most control over clearly are the land use and transportation options. And then I think it's good, too, that we don't back down from the climate change issue on that. This is something that's not controversial with scientists or millennials. And I think as community leaders, we need to continue to talk about climate change, because there's a great deal of misinformation out there. And as a city, and also, I mean, I know we have some groups representing us. We've got CMR and Chamber and the Builders Association, all with representation. And it's important that they make sure, too, that we got to stop putting science deniers in positions of power and start talking, getting to the root of the issue. This is something that if we want to be a community that's appealing and is willing to bring in the workforce, having those kind of discussions where we're just avoiding the issue and hoping that it just goes away is not doing our community any sort of a benefit. So I think that this plan does exactly what it should do. it gives us some good guidance for energy conservation, energy improvements in the future, and I hope we continue to see value from it. I know the interns have, all our fellows have also just found some really easy low-hanging fruit to save us some money too, and we appreciate that, and hopefully we keep it going with this.
All right, anyone else? I had a quick question for Mitzi Baker then. So what's the next step in terms of, do you blend some of the findings and recommendations into the comprehensive plan, or at least create a partner document, if you will? What's the next step in that regard?
What we've talked about is leaving this whole document as a document in and of itself, but pulling from it some of those high-level goals and objectives that would show up in the comprehensive document.
Okay.
Together with the land use and transportation and other objectives. These efforts are really complementary, or very complementary, in terms of some of the energy savings and greenhouse gas reduction opportunities that were highlighted here are completely in step with some of the strategies that have been identified in the comprehensive plan for providing more opportunities for travel options, more opportunities and choices of, for lifestyles, and for reducing the dependence on automobiles so that we can get more efficient use out of our existing transportation system while providing people with more options and how they can develop.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Anyone else? Mr. Mayor?
I had the occasion and was impressed with our two fellows that are here and a while back when I got to visit with them, and I'm looking forward to their report when they finish as well. But I wondered if you, I know we're getting probably a little late, but do you have a quick comment, either of you or both of you, about the presentation?
I'm just going to say that we're going to have the pleasure of addressing you in a few weeks, I think, so we're going to reserve our comments.
Okay.
Very good.
Well played. Quick study over there.
I told you I was impressed.
Okay. Any final comments? Well, thank you very much for a very well-done report, very comprehensive, and we look forward to incorporating findings. Moving on to Parks and Recreation Master Plan update, Mr. Whitman.
Sure. I'll just make a few comments as Rita Trapp from HKGI prepares to share the information with you. It's been a very active season this summer in Parks and Recreation, and that was even before Pokemon Go came into play. a lot of people out in parks, and I guess whatever it takes to get them out, we welcome the safe activity and safe use of parks. We thank you for your support of this master plan process, and as you recall, maybe to recap for some of the folks that are visiting, this came to be because there were several projects, initiatives that we had discussed with council, and questions came up about master plan and when the last one was completed for parks, and the answer to that, as far as we know, is this is the first system-wide master plan for Rochester Parks and Recreation. We're very pleased to be presenting this to you today. I'd like to thank Rita, who will be leading us through this. There's members of our board who are here, our board chair, Larry Mortensen, John Sipple, Dick Dale, I believe that is all, and members of the council who assisted, Mr. Campion, Mr. Ruska, Mr. Scanlon and Bernie Esser, as well as Larry Mortensen, were on the advisory committee, which was a great cross-section of the community to help out with this. I will just point out, as far as a concurrent initiative that is under the direction of our board, Larry Mortensen, we have a long-term funding committee that is looking at sustaining our system over the future. And that kind of gets at what we will be doing with this plan. We will be bringing those two efforts together to look at everything from parkland dedication to establishing a foundation to looking at the traditional funding streams we have and how we can have the most impact from those, how we present that information to you when we come to talk about our budget and funding requests, and to have that plan and knowing that it's had good community engagement, and just find out what the our
of the residents of Rochester are expecting from us and move forward with that. So all that is coming together in very positive ways. I'd like to thank Mike, who has shepherded this process from our staff. And with that, I'll turn it over to Rita, Mike, whoever wants to take it from here. So thank you.
All right, Mayor, members of the council, members of the public, thank you for the opportunity. My intention here today is to provide an overview of the process and what the conclusions were. You have this afternoon, I believe, received a link, so you have access to all of the components of the system plan. There are 6 chapters, 134 pages, so lots to read. And we hope that you have a chance to dig into it and see all of the recommendations. I believe my colleague Mark Kobler was here back in January and talked with you about the guiding principles. And just to bring us first full circle, these are the 6 guiding principles, the 4 that was guiding the development of the master plan. So in essence, this is the vision for the park and recreation system for Rochester. We're seeking to support excellence in the system as well as excellence in the community, cultivating health, creating connections, encouraging exploration, being flexible and responsive, that's both to trends, to funding, to the variety of opportunities that may exist, and growing gracefully. So the system plan is organized in a similar manner to the comprehensive plan. As many of you are aware, our firm is preparing both the comprehensive plan and the system plan. So one of the initiatives that we had was to try and make sure that these 2 documents link to each other. And in that effort, we have a similar structure in terms of our recommendations. We have goals, which are broad statements that describe the desired outcomes and their longer term in scope. Policies are general courses of actions and strategies, which are programs, actions, practices used to implement policy statements. One thing I hear from the comprehensive plan folks is that we have a lot more strategies than maybe the comprehensive plan. And that has to do with the difference between a comprehensive plan, which is a very large-scale planning initiative, and a system plan, which really is giving guidance on the operation of the park and recreation system. So we have a lot more specific strategies and steps that are recommended as part of our plan than maybe you will see in the comprehensive plan. The intent is to take the goals and policies from this document and integrate them into the comprehensive plan and bring out some really planning-level recommendations from our plan into that document. And so you will see that synergy as you review the comprehensive plan. Our recommendations are organized in 9 areas. They are parks, facilities, trails, natural areas, programming, sustainability, public health, public arts, and management and operations. And these topics came through the discussion of the advisory committee through our inventory that we did as part of the beginning of the process. So these are really the areas that we have focused on throughout the planning process. I primarily today will highlight some of the findings from parks, facilities, and trails, not that the other areas aren't important. These areas, though, parks, facilities, and trails, are a lot of the infrastructure that people think of when they think of a park and recreation system, and they are some of the bigger investments that the community will make, so that's why I chose to highlight those. Obviously, the entire document has all of the recommendations, and you can review those. One way that we chose to help us understand how the park and recreation system is organized is by looking at zones and subzones. When you're looking at distribution of recreational facilities and making sure that there's equity, it's important to have some type of geographic basis on which you're trying to make sure folks can easily access those facilities. And so we have divided the community into 5 zones. Those zones do match up with your park dedication policy, being you have quadrants in the park dedication system. So these do match that because it's easier if we're going to talk about investments in facilities or making sure you have distribution of facilities that they match. And then we have them divided into subzones. The major connectivity barriers like roadways and waterways were really the reasons how we chose to make the subzones. The one exception is you'll see H in the center of the screen, the central zone. That zone is in all of the different quadrants. You only have 4 quadrants in your park dedication. We have that central zone called out specifically because that one operates slightly different than the remaining of the zones. And so we really have looked at that one separately. There are fewer opportunities for redevelopment or new park development in that area. So how we have to look at that area is different than the other 4 zones that we have. In terms of access, one of the key foundational aspects that we look at in park and recreation system planning is ensuring that neighborhood parks, community parks, natural areas are within a reasonable distance from folks. So we look at neighborhood parks, making sure that they're within a 10 to 15 minute walk. In the plan, you'll actually see all of the parks and how that lays out. But this map is trying to call out where we see gaps in the system. The arrows on the northwest and northeast are where we need to add new neighborhood parks and community parks as the city grows. In the central area, improving access to the natural areas. On the west side of 52, there's kind of a gap, partly because there's a lot of commercial and industrial development in that side of the city, so the access is not as great in that area. Obviously, Cascade Lake will help in some respects, but that's still a little farther than we want it to be. Improving access, again, on the south side of the community where the asterisk is, and then on the southeast, that is one area of the city where we found a lot of gaps in terms of facilities, in terms of access. So as things happen in the southeast, we need to pay particular attention to that area. In terms of community parks, we're trying to make sure that we're within a 15-minute bike ride or a 5-minute car ride. And then we have started to categorize natural areas, talking about small natural areas being 1 acre or less. So that might be just a part of a park that is has grasslands or has trees or ways that people can access nature very conveniently. And then looking at larger natural areas, generally part of your community and regional parks, but there are other large natural areas in the city. So again, trying to make sure that we have those convenient. And then as a second step, which I didn't include in here, is trying to ensure that they are walkable and bikeable, that there aren't major barriers. And so that's one part of the plan. We have an areas of need where we really looked at where are the areas of concentrations of lower income populations, minority or groups of ethnicities, and try to look at where are barriers for them to access resources in the community. In terms of facilities, in order to address the plentiful amount of facilities, by facilities I mean tennis, softball, baseball, basketball, it's a lot of facilities. In order to help us, including our own firm, understand all the different facilities and how they should be distributed through the facility, through the community, we actually separated it into what we called informal, so things that you may go and meet up with your friends, you may take your family and go to a playground or to a park or go do a quick game of tennis, to things that are informal leagues or tournaments where you might have your group that plays lacrosse or football, and it's mostly about people in town that are meeting together, looking at regional amenities. So you'll see I've broken up the facilities discussion into those areas because it's easier for us to talk about. So in terms of recommendations for informal, we're looking at tennis, and really this map shows pretty good. Really, there's some concentrations currently, as you know, as Kutski, there's a lot of tennis courts. We could benefit from transitioning to groups that are more distributed around the community so people can access them easier. As I mentioned, you can see on here, the southeast zone has some gaps that we need to address. Pickleball, making sure there's striping in each zone. Basketball, there was already a transition happening in the community from full court basketball in neighborhood parks to trying to get them to more community parks and athletic complexes, just from an impact to the surrounding neighborhood. But we can certainly look at adding half courts, which helps to address some of the concerns about parking and noise and groups of people gathering. And so those are some of the recommendations. And at the end, making sure that we have half of all neighborhood parks have an open play field that's nearby that they can go and play soccer, they can have baseball practice, or they can have any types of gatherings that they may want. So in terms of local tournaments and leagues, again, kind of the movement today is about consolidation. What we've termed rectangular fields means soccer, football, and lacrosse, and diamond fields means softball and baseball. That's just to make it easier for all of us to talk about. So trying to look at consolidating baseball, softball, soccer into fewer and high-quality locations. It helps with efficiency. It helps with scheduling for the different associations. There is a need in the community for more for football, lacrosse, and rugby. Looking at one set of 7 tennis courts, so maybe not keeping Kutski to the same level it has been as we're trying to distribute it throughout the community, but making sure we have a sufficient quality tennis facility to hold tournaments, local tournaments that may need to happen. I'm going to come back to Soldiers Field as I talk about water a little bit later. Regional, looking at improving Watson Sports Complex for tournament play, maintaining McQuillan and the softball fields as a softball complex. Looking at adding a new rectangular field complex with 10 to 20 10 to 12 fields, maintaining Grand Arena, National Volleyball Center, those types of facilities. The one thing I want to note, when we talk about regional facilities, that is trying to make sure that those facilities mentioned have the amenities, the scoreboards, the lighting, the concessions, the parking, all of those things so that we can serve the regional marketplace for tournaments. So we've tried to be very specific on which of those complexes are looked at for regional play and which sports that we're really trying to serve. In terms of winter, looking at one outdoor rink per zone, trying to look at 2 to 3 locations for sledding and groomed cross-country skiing at 6 locations. One thing I want to note about winter, there was a lot of discussion at the advisory group about trying to do more in the wintertime, trying to add opportunities, adding programming, adding events, trying to get people out and experiencing it in a new way. So that's one of the reasons we focus more on winter than maybe might be expected. As I said, I was going to come back to aquatics. Maintaining the rec center, Foster Aarons, and Cascade Lake is recommended in the plan. In terms of looking at the pools, replacing Soldiers Field with a lap pool, children's area, and pool activities, the advisory committee very specifically looked at not doing a water park to that scale, but looking at something that would be a community asset. Maintaining a lap pool so that the aquatics, the swimming community had a place to go outdoors, but adding amenities, and when I say pool activities, those are things like the climbing walls, the basketball courts, those types of things, but not escalating it to the water slide recommendation. And part of that is a cost, and part of it was a recognition of what else is surrounding Rochester that maybe we don't need to get to that level, given all of the types of investments that are desired for Rochester. In order to make sure that we have water features throughout the community and that they're free, was trying to add interactive water features. By that I mean splash pads or plazas that have water or access to the river in places where that makes sense, and trying to make sure, again, as I said, the zones come into play, making sure in each one of those zones that I mentioned that there's something nearby that people only have to spend 10 or 15 minutes getting to, and then they can provide that free access to water play, as that was felt to be an important asset, and given the community and the lake or lack thereof of lots of lakes in the community, that that's a real expectation that folks have in the community. Then in terms of specialized, there are more specialized groups than I can manage to say today, but this is kind of a highlight. Managing the golf course to meet demand and trends, and the park board did a great golf subgroup, and so their recommendations have been incorporated into the system plan. Expanding and improving the existing skate park at Silver Lake, and I know there's a group that's interested in partnering with the community on that. Maintaining river access and expanding through partnerships, there is interest in providing more access to the river for rowing, canoeing, and kayaking, and trying to look how that also interplays with Olmsted County and the access that they're looking at. And then distributing throughout the city, and this is where we're kind of trying to use the zones and trying to look at citywide, making sure as your community is growing, it's getting more and more challenging to get across the community to different facilities. So trying to make sure that we either have a facility in each quadrant or on each side of the city so that people have access. So 4 disc golf courses, 4 dog parks, 3 mountain biking, 2 archery facilities. We have recommendations, as I said, this one's very detailed, down to the horseshoe courts and how many horseshoe courts you need. So we have all of those recommendations in the system plan. Trails, just to talk a little bit about trails, the city already has regional trail connections within the community, and on this map you'll see dotted lines that go out to the west, to the east, to the south. We didn't do to the north because you already have Douglas Trail, so trying to really talk about the importance of regional trail connections as part of this planning process. Cross-city trails, that's a term that we've used to try and promote a better understanding in the community about the fact that there are trails that exist that can get you across the community. And so this is about better marketing of the existing system. There are also 12 loops that the city already has that people can use to do a loop. A lot of folks like when they're doing recreational walking or biking actually to do a loop and come back. 1 mile, 3 mile loops, and the city already has that. They already are marketing it, but it's not all in one place and all on one map. So that's something that we recognize as part of this process. And we propose additional loops to be named that already exist within the city, and looking at least one larger loop per zone. So at least in every zone, you could go to a 3 mile loop and have some type of recreational asset in the community. As you know, the trail system is built by both the parks and Public Works, so it's an interesting aspect of trying to do a park and rec system plan is that many of the components of the trail system are actually constructed by Public Works and under their purview as a part of, rather than the purview of Parks and Recreation. And
quick question.
Yeah.
Here. Just in my head, I thought
oh,
you
that's good. Sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I couldn't see him, so thank you for doing that. So this map shows the different types of recommendations in terms of near-term and long-term recommendations for trail connections. So what we tried to do, there's already, as you know, the bikeway system plan. So we're trying to not duplicate efforts. We're trying to complement efforts. We're also trying to recognize and support efforts by Public Works to construct trails that help us access the park and recreation system. And then, in turn, the Parks and Recreation trail recommendations are trail system components that help support the commuter routes and or the access to the park and recreation system that are on park and rec land. So that's one of the distinctions that we're making is there's a lot of park and recreation can do on their own land. When it's not, it's about partnerships with Public Works and prioritizing those types of investments. So this map tries to show both. The yellow line on 52, there was a recommendation through our planning process to really talk about enhanced street corridor and getting connectivity over 52 in that particular area. So that's trying to make sure that that's a discussion that stays current as there are opportunities that we continue to focus on those. So those are the high-level highlights of all the types of things. As I said, there's a lot more highlights than I wanted to walk you through this evening. I did want to touch on community engagement. All of the recommendations were reviewed by the advisory committee and then also by the park board before we met and went out to the community. We did have community engagement. It was not as robust, unfortunately, for us in the spring as it was in the fall. As in the fall, I'm sure you've heard, we had a survey with 3,200 individual comments. It's a lot harder for people to review recommendations and the depth of recommendations that we had. So we didn't have as much participation as we would have liked. I think the people that did participate were knowledgeable about the system and really provided good insights. And there are changes that were made to the recommendations based on those comments that we received. But we did do attempt outreach in a few different ways, online, community meeting, and through the Diversity Council. So then we come with all of these recommendations, trying to boil them down to prioritization. We gathered all of the different recommendations and really focused them into four separate areas and asked the Park and Rec, the Advisory Committee and the Park Board to review prioritization. And if you can, the green lines that go across are kind of where people identify different priority levels. So development of Cascade Lake Regional Park was kind of the high priority, then the middle group is all about the same amount of priority that folks placed on that, and it moves its way down. You'll see on the right-hand side our costs. We're trying to work on the ones that say varies a little bit more. It's very difficult to come up with high-level costs because there's such a variable that can happen depending on how much you want to accomplish. But we are working on providing some more cost estimating. And in the park, in the actual documents, for example, on modernization of facilities, it actually walks you through what was included, so you can see what those are. Mike had a comment.
From a cost standpoint, also, just like to point out, these are just a snapshot in time, too. As time goes on, those costs are going to increase. It's, yeah, it's just a matter of giving you some parameters of what that cost exposure is going to be for the city.
So in terms of prioritization, we have four categories. The intention was to not prioritize across categories because it's hard to decide that Cascade Lake Regional Park is more important than developing the department's website, and those are hard priorities to do. So we have them in the different categories. I also want to note that it's understood that it may be that you are able to accomplish something lower on the priority list through partnerships or through opportunities or just the cost is less, so you're able to accomplish some of these. Some of these may take longer. So this is just a starting point for discussion and also a great way for us to understand what type of investment is really needed in order to build the park and recreation system that we seem to have been hearing is needed as part of the planning process. So this is all of the facilities that were highlighted. In terms of marketing, by and large, the biggest desire was for improved department website and social media presence. Communications is very tough in this community, as I heard throughout. There's just so much information, so many groups doing great work that it's hard to get the message across, so additional work in that area. You'll note on the marketing, and then again on the next couple of slides, I have what's called staffing and additional staffing. That means that our estimate is that within the current staffing that you have in the Parks and Recreation Department, that it probably that particular area, that initiative can get accomplished. In order to tackle some of these others, additional staffing is going to be needed because of the complexity of those areas. It's just not possible with what the staff is already doing to add on some additional initiatives. So these are the initiatives in the area of marketing. In terms of programming and events, trying to really focus, I think everyone's focus was drawing residents to park and recreation facilities, trying out activities, getting engaged in the community. It's not about creating new programming or duplicating what other partnership organizations are doing. So it's really about trying to figure out what the gap is and filling the gaps in those areas. And then operations, kind of the focus areas, higher level of service for care, maintenance, and cleanliness. And one note I made at the park board meeting that I feel is important to make here is that it's likely that some of the concern regarding care, maintenance, and cleanliness may be addressed if the modernization of facilities that's mentioned three slides ago takes place. So as, for example, if some of the shelters that people currently feel like just aren't quality get replaced, some of this may be addressed, because it's not clear to me as we work through this process that it's not about staff doing a poor job on cleanliness and maintenance. It's just some of the facilities are old and they need to be replaced, and we haven't gotten to doing that yet. So, as I mentioned at the beginning, the system draft was distributed today. We're asking for all the advisory committee, the park board, and the city council to review and provide comments. We have an advisory committee meeting, the last one, later this week, and we'll have their opportunity to provide feedback as a group and then individually through comments. We're hoping to receive the comments and edits by the end of next week, and then the park board would review it at their August 9th meeting, is the hope at least. So we're looking for feedback and appreciate the time that you might spend reviewing that and letting us know where we can enhance or improve the document. With that, anything else? Okay. Any questions or
all
aspects
right.
I didn't cover?
Thank you. Questions, comments? Mr. Ruskin.
Well, Rita, as usual, nice job. Keeps us right on task for every month for like a year now. We've been sitting through an evening like this. It seems like we've got a task at hand and you stick right to it. And I just want to thank you for the way you've been able to pull everybody's ideas together. There's been a wide array of priorities and ideas and suggestions. And I kind of feel like the bad cop in the group a lot, because it's always about additional money and additional staffing and additional everything, and the city should be providing this, you know, do these things, because that's what we need to be successful in the minds of others. But, the council telling me, I've heard this before, everybody has high expectations but doesn't really want to pay for it, and those are the things that we kind of get caught in as we plan this stuff. And, you know, you have that pie in the sky as where we'd like to be, but how are we going to get there? It's going to take resources and some great planning. We've got the great planning now. Now we've got to put those resources to it and decide what we're going to do. I thought it was a great exercise of a lot of people working a lot of hours to come up with this. And I enjoyed the process. Some of the things I don't all agree with, and I think that's how we all went through this thing, is we all added suggestions and comments, but we didn't agree with everything. But that's, I think we have a great outcome here, so I appreciate your work and the work of everybody that served on that committee.
Mr. Campion.
I might add that I think one of the other benefits that is being alluded to is also all of the other users being in the same room and hearing all the requests from other kind of special interest groups that are going on. So we want a pool, and we want a ski hill, and we want a grooming machine, and we want a plow, and hearing all of the different groups, it's at least a little taste for everyone that's participating of kind of that need to prioritize. So I think, again, one of the more useful components I hope comes up, and it seems like it's starting to pull together, is just that prioritized list of, you know, if we're going to really go after it, here's the strategy we can use and our staff can execute to kind of get the best bang for our buck. And I echo the sentiment, appreciate kind of the guiding hand of going through this process. So thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Well, thank you. We look forward to incorporation of the report findings into some of the subsequent discussion and documents. All right. I know we're running a little shy on time here, but I did want to, with respect to Mr. Wojcik's request, he had asked us to consider a topic Did everyone see the email earlier this afternoon where it sounds like maybe the office is not closing?
Half.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead?
30 seconds. Should be really simple. I'm asking the city to send a letter to our legislative delegation and state officials saying we oppose the closing of, potential closing of the two offices that we have established down here. One is the Chicano Latino Council, and the other one is the Council of Venezuelans of African Heritage, I think is what it's called now. And sounds like the one is going to at least be preserved down here. The other one may still be cut, but the bottom line is we are a huge net payer to the state of Minnesota, and I think we're doing some very good things in the community with all the turmoil in the world around us. We have some really good positive discussions between communities of color and the police down here, and I just think this would be a big step backwards at a time where we shouldn't be doing it, and ultimately it's going to be their decision, but I thought it, you know, since we were contacted by a citizen, I thought it least we could do is send a letter to the state and our officials stating our position. That's all I got.
Who would be in the best position to draft that document?
I figure the city administrator has several hundred employees, and I trust him on that.
What thoughts from the council? What would you like to do?
Mr. Bildebag. It's fine. I support that. I think we have a huge population that helps represent, and so I support
the vote.
I have some reservations for the simple reason that recently here we sent a letter up to the state really encouraging additional funding for our courts and for our judges, and we all agreed how important that was, mm-hmm. and what a priority that was, and we've sent that up there to ask if they could do that. Now I think it maybe could be perceived as a kind of a confusing to send another letter up asking, you know, is there a priority of what, you know, is this more important than the other now and stuff. So I guess being that the positions are being taken care of, I guess I'm kind of concerned about us getting into this where it looks like it's being dealt with the state without sending a mixed message that we've already have a letter up there requesting something that we've all agreed is very important to us in the future of the community here too. So, I guess that's something I'd like to consider with before jumping into this.
Anyone else? Mr. Campion.
I guess if you don't ask, they can't give it to you to some degree, so I would be in favor of asking and kind of letting it play out. It probably doesn't clarify the relative priority, but I think sending a letter requesting that we maintain those offices, I think, hopefully doesn't hurt the situation at all. I think it could improve that situation quite a bit to see we value these local positions and that they make a meaningful difference to our community and they service an important part of our community. So I guess I would support sending one as well.
All right. Anyone else? I understand what Mr. Rusk is saying. I've been one of those individuals that asked for a letter of support from the city for one thing or other. I think some of the regional wastewater treatment and things like that, things that we feel are important to our region. So I'm not opposed to sending a letter. I'd like to see it first and then
yeah.
Or at least route it around so that
yep,
we can see how it's crafted.
Yeah, and I would mention I'm a former ranger. We're famous for asking for way more stuff than we deserve and getting it, so.
All right, so is there a consensus from the council that we would ask?
I'm okay with that. I'm just bringing that point up that, you know, we've got, you know, you start asking for a bunch of different things, and they've got their reasons for doing things, their budgets and their priorities, and, I know of how important it's been to all of us to get this additional judge down here, and so I hope we don't lose focus of that.
Ms. Mean?
Can we have Mr. Donovan Bailey here if he can make a comment if it's agreeable with the council?
If you'd like.
I would, if
all right.
Consensus.
Sure, I'm sorry I just walked in, but I suppose you're speaking about the council and
yep.
My letter of support. As I understand it, as a former member of the Council of Black Minnesotans, which is now Council on Minnesotans of African Heritage, there was some thought that council might be nullified, and from what I heard this morning, it will not be. It will be continuing the office here. But from what I do hear, I think it has happened, and Ms. Sardowski is here to report on that. The Black Council has been, is no longer here. concerning. I don't have to develop why that's concerning given the issues in our nation. But that council certainly is not here. What I heard, the buzz was that eventually that would impact the Council of Black Minnesota, that Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage. So my concern in putting this forth to our respected leaders is that we don't need that at this time. We need these councils, and we need them here to help us facilitate this new era that we're in. So I would certainly be behind you all supporting that. And if indeed the CLAC Council does not come back, I would suggest, I think, for the platform, that we as a city take on our own council of that nature so that we continue that rhetoric and that conversation. So.
All right.
Very interesting. That's, I think that, you know, we can all take a look at a draft and make sure it reads like we want it to read, but I just think it's important we, you know, stick our nose out there for some folks that, you know, we're working real hard to build positive relationships with in the community.
All right. So is there a consensus? We would ask administration to draft a letter for consideration. All right.
Get one drafted.
Yeah, perfect. I think half a page is great, one page is wonderful.
Yeah.
I just want to comment that I have been a member of the Council of Minnesota African Heritage, and we agreed to submit a letter to our local legislators and to Mr. Daut, D-A-U-G-T. And asking for support in this area, realizing that we have had a great impact on the state economically. We're doing some pretty significant work in the city that's beneficial to all of us and all of the state, throughout the state. And that response was never received. They never responded to it. So I think, and there was no more follow-up on that. Perhaps with this body pulling together and making sure we get a follow-up discussion, even if we have to take it to the government, that we need the courtesy of a response.
All right. Okay, thank you. One other real quick comment with respect to time. One thing I wanted to talk about is we did receive a third proposal for the building, the armory, and then a question was raised by one or two council members as far as whether we should consider that or not. So I'd like people to be thinking about that, and maybe under other business this evening we can talk. We won't be reviewing the proposal, but let's talk a little bit about process, whether we're going to look at it or whatever else. So let's take that up this evening.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we are adjourned.
That was the quickest item I ever brought to the meeting.
That's an award.